Velkommen til Aflyttet med Anders Kjær Ulf.
Velkommen til et program, der indfører skæg og blå briller, i hvert fald indeni, og indeni er denne gang udenpå i Bruxelles, hvor konferencen CPDP, Computers Privacy and Data Protection, afholdes for 8. år i træk. Som du kan høre, så er der en hel del snak. Det er alle de her deltagere, som nu har fri efter en lang dag med seminarer og taler, og nu taler de med hinanden. Konferencen, den er civil og tiltrækker borgerrettighedsfolk fra hele verden sammen med EU-politikerne, politimyndighederne og en længere række diskrete grå mænd, der helt sikkert også er i branchen for skæg og blå briller, men som går noget mere stille med det, end jeg gør. Og jeg hedder Jørgen Anders Kjær Ulf og er din vært. Her i programmet, der skal du møde en træt idealist og en optimistisk professor. Professoren, han hedder Ian Brown, og han er ikke den eneste optimist, jeg har med i dag. Der er også internetaktivisten Max Schrems. Schrems, han kører for tiden en gigantisk retssag mod Facebook for ikke at overholde EU's datalovgivning og for at udlevere oplysninger om deres kunder til NSA. Til sidst, der skal vi møde direktøren fra verdens mest hemmelige krypterede telefon. Den hedder Blackphone, og han hedder Toby Veer Jones, og hans forretning går strygende. Men først skal vi have en status for privatliv og overvågning i Europa lige nu. Velkommen til Aflytte fra Bruxelles.
Hi, I'm TJ McIntyre from Digital Rights Ireland, and I'm a lecturer in law in University College Dublin.
Could you, since you're in digital rights, this is a very broad question to begin with. What's the state of privacy currently in Europe?
Well, privacy in Europe is in a state of flux. Really, what happens in the wake of the Snowden revelations and our own judgment from the European Court of Justice is going to determine what privacy looks like for the next 20 years at least. So really it's important that we get the General Data Protection Regulation right.
That's the General Data Protection Regulation has been kind of been in store, and everybody says now we will get this working. And there's been a lot. I was here 2 years ago. Everybody was talking about the General Data Protection Regulation, and it's not really coming along. What's stopping it?
I think the problem with the Data Protection Regulation is the opposition of national governments. I think what we've seen from the Commission and the Parliament has overwhelmingly been positive. I think the Council is determined at this stage to water down the protections that are in place. And there is a real risk that if we don't get a protective regulation, we might be better off with no regulation at all.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the problem is that the regulation could potentially water down some of the protections that we currently do enjoy. And a number of people have said we might be better off simply accepting if we can't get an agreement on a new regulation, then perhaps we should stick with what we have until such time as we can get a more effective regulation.
Trinity McIntyre, eller TJ McIntyre for Digital Rights Ireland, mener, at Europa står i stampe, sådan rent privatlivsmæssigt. Vi venter nemlig alle sammen på, at EU's nye dataforordning, den med retten til at blive glemt og en generelt hævet beskyttelse af borgerne for alvor, skal vedtages og anvendes. Det venter kommissionen på, og det har vi alle sammen ventet på i over 2 år, siger han. Imens vi har ventet på det, så er loven imens blevet mere og mere udhulet af lobbyister, og hvis der ikke snart sker noget, så kan det være, at det vil være bedre helt uden en ny lov, mener altså TJ McIntyre.
I think the new attacks can be... you can put too much emphasis on the recent attacks, because fundamentally we've seen an environment where terrorism is portrayed as a new development, it's portrayed as a specifically Islamic threat, when in fact from an Irish perspective we see a much different tradition of terrorism going back much longer, which never justified the same intrusions on civil liberties. Likewise, the Spanish have had a long experience of this with, for example, Basque separatists, which has never been put forward before as a justification. So it's very ahistorical to say we're now at a new and changing time.
TJ McIntyre fra Digital Rights Ireland kunne sidste år fejre, hvad han troede var en stor, stor sejr. Efter en årlang retssag, der bestemte EU's menneskerettighedsdomstol nemlig, at det var i strid med EU's charter om menneskerettigheder at masseovervåge borgere generelt, når der ikke var nogen konkret mistanke imod dem. Det betød et farvel til Loch Ness-bekendtgørelsen i mange europæiske lande. Dog ikke i Danmark, hvor Justitsministeriet ikke mente, der var noget, der skulle laves om, undtagen den såkaldte sessionslogning, der alligevel ikke virkede, og som man i øvrigt nu er i gang med at genindføre ovenpå terroren i Frankrig.
The British attack and the Paris attacks are the perfect example of why more surveillance isn't what's needed. Because in Britain, in the case of the Lee Rigby killers, they were already under surveillance. In Paris, in the case of the Charlie Hebdo attackers, they were already under surveillance. The idea that we can have more effective searching for needles in haystacks by making the haystacks bigger is not one that has any credibility after those attacks.
Edward Snowdens afsløringer har betydet rigtig meget for bevidstheden om datasikkerhed og privatliv, men vi mangler altså at gøre noget konkret, mener TJ McIntyre.
Our digital rights, how have they evolved after Snowden? Has it gone in the right direction?
I don't think there's been much evolution in terms of digital rights as such after Snowden, with the one exception of the Digital Rights Ireland judgment, which obviously was very heavily influenced by the revelations. That aside, and with a few national court judgments on data retention, there's been very little in the way of substantive change, very little in the way of changes in domestic laws or domestic constitutions, domestic practices. So for the time being, you don't have much change in the law as you do change in awareness. So the hope has to be the change in awareness leads ultimately to change in the law.
Det var altså Trinity McIntyre fra Digital Rights Ireland. Han er uddannet advokat, og det er den næste, du skal møde faktisk også. Han hedder Ian Brown og er professor på Oxford Internet Institute. Og han undersøger blandt andet, hvordan man skal bære sig ad med at holde øje med ekstremister og terrorister på internettet, uden at krænke vores allesammens ret til privatliv. Og det kan man sagtens, mener han. Hør bare her.
We've seen a lot of discussion at the political level in parliaments in all the European countries and in the US, in the European Parliament itself. We've seen a lot of media debate. What we haven't seen so far is any significant change. So there have been efforts in the US Congress to pass a USA Freedom Act that would have restricted some of the NSA activities revealed by Snowden. That bill didn't get enough votes to get through Congress. We've seen a lot of criticisms from the European Parliament, but actually going from criticisms to legislative change is maybe we'll see that in the next year or two, but at the moment it doesn't seem there's strong enough political pressure to make that happen, especially when we have incidents like the shootings in Paris, which then of course make people very concerned about safety.
What happens when people get very concerned about safety?
Well, we've seen post 9/11, post other terrorist attacks, you know, quite understandably, these things are huge news. They're designed to be huge news. That's the whole point of terrorist attacks, to terrorize people. And then you get a lot of voices within government saying, well, if we're going to stop things like this happening in future, the state needs more surveillance powers and capabilities to do that.
Where do you see this? Is this already happening some places? Could you give me some examples?
Well, in the UK, I know very well, of course, listening to the media reporting every day, the UK government, David Cameron, the Prime Minister, has made speeches saying, for example, that internet technology is becoming more difficult for the UK government to monitor, and perhaps they need new powers and new capabilities to get through encrypted communications, for example.
Umiddelbart lyder Ian Brown fra Oxford University lige så deprimeret som TJ McIntyre fra Digital Rights Ireland. Terroren i Paris har fået politikerne til at gå i panik og har som sådan netop nået det egentlige mål, der er med terror, nemlig at gøre os bange og få os til at ophæve vores frihedsrettigheder, siger han. Og i England der er David Cameron gået endnu videre. Han vil ikke have, at borgerne kommunikerer krypteret og hemmeligt. Staten skal kunne lytte med. Det er alt sammen slemt, men hvorfor er Ian Brown så stadig optimist? Og efter Edward Snowden, hvor vi alle sammen ved, hvad et overvågningssamfund kan, bliver det så ikke bare endnu værre det hele?
I think we need a lot more thought from governments about what capabilities they really genuinely need to catch terrorists, to stop terrorist incidents happening as far as that's possible. It's not always possible. But doing that in a way and talking to civil society groups and talking to business about how to do that as far as possible to still protect people's privacy. I think one of the very positive things that's come out of the Snowden revelations is now that everyone has a lot better understanding about what actually is happening, what governments are doing, that can lead to a conversation where even ardent privacy campaigners might acknowledge some of these capabilities are important, whereas others, there's much less evidence that they are necessary to catch and to prevent terrorism.
Aren't we actually risking that the fact that we now know what is going on just means, and since nothing is changing, it just becomes kind of part of what the landscape we're trying to maneuver in, and we just say, oh, it is like that, so we can't talk about this and we can't do that?
I don't think the fact all of these surveillance activities are now public makes it any harder to get change. I think actually them staying secret, you know, if nobody knows the details of what's going on, then you just can't have the detailed, credible discussions you need in public to make any change happen at all.
One of the main problems, the main points about Edward Snowden's revelations is that mass surveillance or bulk collection of surveillance is going on. How do you see the future for mass surveillance? Is that a continuing problem, or will that change over time?
What the UK and US and other governments say is they need some kinds of bulk collection because they just otherwise can't pull out the data of the specific targets that they have. I think what we need is much more debate and discussion about where are their alternatives. So the US National Academy's just published a report in the last week saying they think for now there is not technology that lets you do much more targeted interception and capture of communications. I hope we can go on having that discussion, and that computer scientists, of course, are building new technologies all the time, because I think what everyone wants is technology that lets you do targeted surveillance when necessary, when overseen by a judge and by Parliament. All those safeguards are in place without scooping up lots of data about people that are not suspicious or target of investigation.
The EU used to have in stock a very large Data Protection Act, which actually was supposed to give the citizens more rights and more oversights of what is happening. That has been in the pipeline for a very long time. Do you think it's going to make it?
It looks like probably in the next year, the EU Council of Ministers and the EU Parliament will be able to come to finally an agreement on what the new data protection regulation will look like. There's so much political momentum behind it. Although a small number of countries like the UK are sceptical, I think that will happen in the next year.
Edward Snowdens afsløringer har vist os, hvordan systemet virker. Men det har også fået selv de mest hardcore privatlivsforkæmpere til at indse, at målrettet overvågning kan være meget effektiv og god. Det handler bare om kun at overvåge de, man allerede har en mistanke til, siger altså Ian Brown, der også tror, at EU's dataforordning bliver vedtaget i løbet af dette eller næste år, og men måske i en noget mildere udgave, end den oprindeligt var tænkt. Men indtil videre lever vi altså med masseovervågning. Hvad gør det egentlig ved vores idé om det at være uskyldig til det modsatte er bevist?
I think this is one reason that mass surveillance is so problematic. And you see that, I mean, of course, you see it in people's day-to-day behavior. So we've seen one study in the US which showed that people actually very broadly were slightly nervous about talking about the Snowden revelations, both in social media online, but also offline with their colleagues and with their families. So it does have an effect on everyone. It particularly, though, has an effect on professions like journalism, like lawyers, like doctors, where confidentiality is really important. We've seen in the US and in the UK cases where the FBI and the UK police have used this surveillance technology to track down whistleblowers and journalist sources within government and elsewhere and prosecute them. And that's really very, very damaging for the freedom of the media.
It also changes our way of the law, actually, in many ways.
It does. I think, again, a positive outcome of the Snowden revelations is it's brought all of this state activity out into the public for debate, where we can say, look, there are international legal rules about privacy protection. It seems like sometimes the large states were just ignoring those, and I think it's important for the international rule of law that we now have a meaningful discussion about changing those practices so they are in conformance with international law. I really don't think it works for the big Western democracies, on the one hand, to be lecturing authoritarian states about a free internet, and on the other, breaking international law themselves.
Masseovervågning har massive konsekvenser for os alle sammen, siger Ian Brown. Borgerne er begyndt at tænke over, hvad de siger, hvornår, og faggrupper som læger, advokater og journalister, hvor fortrolighed er vigtig, lider under det. Men for Brown er det vigtigste stadig, at vi taler om det, og måske kan få gode fælles internationale love ud af det. Men hvad med ytringsfriheden, den som netop nu diskuteres for fuldt tryk hjemme i Danmark? Kan den reguleres og puttes i love?
Well, I don't think we can stop people saying stupid things on the internet. I think clearly you can. It's open to societies, of course, as many European nations have done, to say there are certain ideas like promotion of racism, promotion of xenophobia, even promotion of genocide, which particularly in countries like France and Germany, where there have been very clear problems in the recent historical period coming out of that. You can understand that, no matter how much of a fan of free speech you are. Enforcing those rules, of course, the police and those responsible for enforcing those rules are having to adjust to platforms, social media platforms, where suddenly anyone can, if a tweet or a Facebook status update goes viral, suddenly reach maybe hundreds of thousands of people, which they could never do before. It was always previously filtered through broadcast media. I think the best approach to take is one where societies, first of all, are very careful on what kinds of speech they try to control, because I think, as a general principle, the solution to bad speech is more speech, not trying to ban the bad speech. But where there are very specific types of speech, I think focusing on ideally punishing the speaker rather than trying to restrict the medium as a whole, rather than trying to use blunderbuss blocking mechanisms, for example, trying to ban people's access through their internet service provider to sites, I think is preferable from a human rights perspective.
Blocking internet sites is also very big, at least in Great Britain currently. How do you see that evolving?
We've seen UK ISPs moving over the last decade roughly from blocking their customers' access to known child abuse images to then being required by the courts to block access to copyright infringing sites like the Pirate Bay, to then also blocking trademark infringing sites. We now see ISPs in Britain offering all of their customers so-called family-friendly internet access. What that means, of course, is banning very large numbers of websites. So I'm not sure that is going in a positive direction for the UK. I mean, of course, there are all sorts of groups and interests who think it's a very tempting idea if they can force ISPs to block access to certain kinds of content. And I think we've been perhaps slightly carried away in the UK about the possibilities of this. I think it's something we should be thinking more carefully about.
You're also very big into blocking pornography.
Well, again, these family-friendly filters, which only allow which don't allow access to so-called adult content. Without saying that every British adult and child is an avid consumer of pornography, of course, sometimes, frequently in fact, that blocking will affect all sorts of content. For example, sexual health advice sites for teenagers, advice for gay and lesbian young teenagers. Actually, the internet is incredibly helpful to people like that are looking for information they might not be able to get in their home community, especially if they're outside big urban centres. And so then to have it taken away again by blocking software, I think, would be a real problem.
Politiet har en ny opgave, for eksempel på Facebook, hvor de nu ser at udvikle nye måder at patruljere og straffe på. Og så er der en stor opgave for lovmager, der skal få balancen til at gå op, så man ikke ødelægger ytringsfriheden, siger altså Ian Brown. Så er der blokade af internetsites, noget vi gør i Danmark i mild grad, men som er meget udbredt i England, hvor blandt andet pornografi bliver blokeret. Og det giver de sædvanlige problemer, for eksempel med sider for bøsser og lesbiske, hvor der er oplysninger og gode råd, de ryger med i blokeringskøbet, siger altså Ian Brown. Men så er der jo igen terrorismen og terroristerne på Facebook.
Terrorism is the new battlefield currently, especially on social media, and there's a lot of discussions in how can you kind of restrict them using this. Do you see this? Is there a way forward doing this? Can you stop terrorists from talking on social media?
In one way, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a magic switch that Facebook and Google and Twitter could flick that says, block all terrorist content? Of course, it's not nearly so simple. The technology just doesn't work like that. But also, I mean, even more basic problems, there is not a broad international consensus even on precisely what terrorism means. There are some things clearly everyone would agree, like the beheadings of aid workers and journalists in the Middle East by ISIS would come under that. But there are all sorts of other groups, some would say freedom fighters, guerrillas, insurgents, carrying out campaigns around the world. How you differentiate between that is a problem. The UK government for a long time called the ANC in South Africa a terrorist group because they were fighting for rights of non-white people in South Africa. So I think these nuances are one reason why simple technical, in quotes, fixes usually have all sorts of unintended consequences.
Det ville jo være rart, hvis man bare kunne blokere alle terroristerne, så de ikke kunne sige noget, siger Ian Brown, men problemet er stadig, hvem der er frihedskæmper og hvem der er terrorister. For eksempel kaldte England i mange år ANC i Sydafrika for en terrorgruppe, og i Europa har der på det seneste været en række problemer med kurderne, hvis væbnede del har været under EU's terrorlov, men som nu kæmper side om side med Vesten mod ISIS. Og så er det, man spørger sig selv og Ian Brown, er vi egentlig blevet mere frie af det her internet? Har vi fået mere ytringsfrihed, eller er vi bare blevet glade ofre for kommercielle interesser og big data indsamling?
As an expert on privacy, how do you see, would you say, do we have more or less privacy today than we had, for example, before the internet?
I think clearly computing technology as a whole, not just the internet, is very good at collecting data. You know, computers are very good at doing repetitive things, collecting data, storing lots of data, processing it, looking for interesting things. So certainly there's that technological push towards the collection and processing of more data. Having said that, I think technology is a human creation. It's up to human beings how technology is designed, how it evolves. It's open to societies, as we have done in Europe, for example, to say privacy remains an important, very important social value. It's not something we should just allow to fade away because of technical change. I think societies do have options in trying to shape technical development to protect privacy, free speech, other human rights.
If you see the two areas where there's actually moving against privacy, and they're doing very openly. One of them is social media, especially Facebook. There are these guys inside Facebook keep saying privacy is dead. They used to say that. I don't think they say that loud anymore. There's another area which is big data, where people are deliberately working on telling people that you don't need privacy because we need. If you keep your privacy, we are not able to cure cancer and stuff like that. Do you see that as a new
too. You hear very much these days about all the benefits of big data, and I absolutely would not argue that there are lots of exciting ways of using data better for doing medical research, for doing all sorts of other socially beneficial activities. I think the important thing is to design those technologies and those research programs in a way that, first of all, you get fully informed consent from people. So, for example, I don't think there's any problem at all with large-scale medical research projects. In the UK, we have a national biobank with 500,000 people that are voluntarily contributing lots and lots of data about themselves, their lifestyles, their genomes to medical research. I think the problem becomes when people doing big data processing get sort of so carried away with it, they say, well, would be even better if we could go from 500,000 UK citizens to all 60 million patients on the National Health Service. I think that is going too far. I think people need to be able to decide for themselves if they want to participate in these big data programs.
Og det var altså Ian Brown fra Oxford Internet Institute, der fortalte her.
It may just be my imagination. Whatever it is that's watching. It's not human.
Aflyttet er til Festival for Privacy og Computersikkerhed. Som man måske kan høre lige nu, så er der en frygtelig masse mennesker. En af dem, det er Max Schrems, internetaktivist, som jeg skal tale med her lige om et øjeblik. Sorry?
You were just calling me too, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, but you can't hear a phone inside there.
I'm sorry, because
there's no problem, no problem. I'm here together with Max Schrems, Facebook activist. You are and a lawyer. You finished law school?
Yeah, the first round. Now we do a PhD because it was all that funny.
You become widely famous for having done the first big instrumentalized case against Facebook. Could you describe what is going on there?
The first round we actually took back in Ireland because Ireland hasn't really enforced anything and hasn't given us any decision for 3 years. And we moved that over to a class action in Vienna, which is now a civil law action. So before that, we've been to the public data protection officer in Ireland that didn't do anything. Now we went to the Austrian court and sued Facebook there. And in Austria, there's a possibility to have a class action so that other people that are Facebook users as well could assign you the claim that you that they have. So we had like a assignment app where you could assign your claim going online. And we got 25,000 people that joined the case. It's pending before the Irish, before the Austrian court right now. The first hearing is going to be in April. And that's kind of the deal here. The other thing that happened is that one of the cases in Ireland went to the European Court of Justice, and that there it's about Prism and the data that Facebook hands over to the NSA. And if that is legal, because if Facebook is a European company, how can they just hand over all the data to the NSA in the end? So all these cases are kind of going their way. Pretty much all of them are looking quite good.
Max Schrems er en tæt, lyshåret og blåret superenergisk jurastuderende fra Østrig, der er i gang med sin Ph.D. på sit studie i Wien. Men han er dengang travlt med noget helt andet, der har optaget ham de sidste 3 år. Det er Facebook. Det begyndte altså med, at han krævede at få udleveret alt, de havde gemt om ham. Først fik han et par sider, men da han lagde pres på, udleverede Facebook over 20.000 siders registreringer af alt, Schrems havde lavet på deres medie. Der var optegnelser over alle hans venner, også dem han havde smidt ud, og alle hans private beskeder, og sågar statuser, der aldrig var blevet sendt videre, men kun skrevet, havde Facebook gemt gennem mange år. Det er stang ulovligt i forhold til europæisk datalov, men ingen har rigtig orket at gøre noget ved det. Undtagen altså Max, der først kørte det igennem det irske datatilsyn uden rigtig at få gang i den, før han fik en partner i en østrigsk advokatfirma, der nu fører sagen sammen med ham. Og han er faktisk ikke alene. Han lavede nemlig en app til sit website, hvor man kunne melde sig som medklager, og dem er der 25.000 af, inklusive undertegnet, og der står lige så mange i kø for at komme med. Første høring i sagen bliver i april, og så er der i øvrigt alligevel sket noget i sagen fra Irland. Den er nemlig endt i den europæiske menneskerettighedsdomstol, i hvert fald den del, der handler om den rigtig slemme del af Facebooks forretning, nemlig at de deler deres data med NSA gennem det såkaldte PRISM-program. Men hvad er det præcis, Max anklager Facebook for at gøre?
Could you shortly describe what's the claim against Facebook on the big class action act, which I actually am one of them who's signed up, so I expect to receive some money maybe if I'm lucky, but what's the claim against them?
Pretty much we have a couple of claims in the class action. First of all, we say that the policies of Facebook are invalid, that this privacy policy you consent to is just not really compliant with the law. There is a claim on PRISM and Safe Harbor that Facebook participates in the PRISM program of the NSA and forwards your data. There are other things like buttons and apps on Facebook that are getting too much data or where Facebook is gathering too much data. There is one claim on big data where Facebook kind of analyzes all your information but also information they have about your friends to kind of get a much deeper picture about you than what you actually share personally. So there are a lot of these different claims in one class action. All of them are kind of researched in a way that they're very credible, very easy to win, and where we also have like all the evidence we need to prove the case. So that looks quite good. All of the claims are tied to a tort law claim that we say we want to have $500 for each user. That's deliberately low. We could have asked very likely for a couple of thousand euro per person, but we wanted to show that this is more about the fact that Facebook changes the policy and that they kind of stick to European law instead of kind of making it a money machine like American class actions are. And the whole thing is kind of interesting because it's financed by a procedure financing company. They get 20% if we win, but if we lose, they take all the cost.
Just to get some sort of perspective on the size of this case, how much the claim against them, how much does it, how big is it? Is it 200 pages?
The lawsuit itself is just 50 pages. And still very, very long for an Austrian lawsuit. We're usually trying to stay below 20 pages. On a monetary value, just the $500 is more than 10 million altogether. However, for Facebook, the bigger problem is if they have to change their practices. The money is not really the issue. If they can pay it off, they would pay it off. The bigger problem is more that they might need to change certain policies and may change have to change their product in Europe. And that is really something where it's about the future money you can make off of a social network. That might be the bigger problem for them in the end.
Anklageskriftet mod Facebook fylder cirka 50 sider, og Schrems og advokatfirmaet kræver 500 euro per klager, omkring 10 millioner euro i alt, penge som advokatfirmaet skal have 25% af, hvis han vinder sagen. Men det handler ikke om penge, siger Max Schrems. Pengene er symbolske, og han er helt sikker på, at Facebook bare ville betale, hvis de vidste, de kunne nøjes med det. Men det kan de efter al sandsynlighed ikke. Vinder Max, skal de ændre deres datapolitik over hele Europa, og det er de ikke meget for. Men Facebook burde kunne tjene penge uden at misbruge deres kunders data, mener Max Schrems.
Pretty much Facebook would look exactly the same as it is today, because what Facebook does in the front end is usually reasonable and makes sense. The big problem is what they do in the backside and in their backyard, and that's everything that users don't see. So a lot of people think that if they have to stick to privacy, that they couldn't use Facebook as it is today. That was interesting because for all the claims we ever filed, we also said you can do it this and that way, which doesn't change the user experience and the front end, but which changes what you do in the backyard, where it's about kind of gathering data from sources, passing that on to other people, stuff like that, that is, that are things that are only possible because the average user doesn't see it. And that is more where we're kind of working on, not necessarily the front end.
One of the big questions here is that what are the reasons that Facebook makes money is what they're doing that users don't see. They make big data and they sell stuff around. You're saying they shouldn't do this because it's semi-illegal and shouldn't do that. How are they supposed to make money in the future?
That's one thing that's really driving me crazy in the debate. We pretty much have the feeling you either give all your money, all your data, and then they can make money, or you don't give your data and then they all run out of business. That's not true. There have been advertisement models for 100 years without using personal data. You can also target on many grounds. The big question is how much data, how invasive, how deep do you want to dig into the soul of the people to just get like 2-3% more clicks? And that is really the debate, what it's about. The industry tries to say either you give us your data or there's no service, which is not true. If you look at newspapers, for example, advertisement there is well paid. Not that well paid today anymore, but still paid, or in the radio or something, without having any targeting, without having any personal data. If advertisement that is not geared towards a person would not work out, then we wouldn't have any billboards on the street. So this idea of we can only have personalized information and only personalized advertisement is just not true in reality. Of course, you can get more money and even more money the deeper you dig into the souls. But then the question is, do you really need to make that much money? I think Facebook makes a decent amount of money overall by digging even deeper in our privacy than you already do. So that's really a balancing question of how far do you go. Especially in the online field, you can target by location, by the IP address, for example, without digging into personal data. You can target by the context of the web page. Someone that is looking at an automotive web page is not going to be interested in flowers too much oftentimes. So you can do a lot of this targeting. You can also use postings. I think it's acceptable that Facebook also looks partly into your private data, but then they have to tell you it's the last month of your data. We only look at your public postings. But how about all the private postings, all the private things, the metadata that they collect in the background, all this stuff, and that for 10 years, then I feel that's kind of out of balance. So it's very much a balancing question of the economic interests of funding a social network we all like and not digging too much into your privacy.
Facebook har masser af muligheder for at tjene penge på annoncer alene, hævder Max Schrems, der heller ikke har noget imod, at de roder lidt i kundernes data, hvis bare det er under kontrol. For eksempel så skal de ikke gemme alting i 10 år, som de gør nu, men højst i 6 måneder, hvis det står til ham. Han er godt klar over, at Facebook vil blive fattigere af det, men på den anden side så er der vel også grænser for, hvor mange penge man skal tjene, siger han. Men en ting er privatlivsaspektet af Facebook-sagen og udnyttelsen af brugernes oplysninger. Noget helt andet er Facebooks forbindelser til NSA og involvering i PRISM, det masseovervågningsprojekt Edward Snowden afslørede i 2013.
I think the PRISM case really demonstrates what is a big problem is that we have like what like this public-private partnership in a lot of the privacy violations. You have a private company collecting all this information that a public company could never do or a public entity could never do, and then you have the government looking into all of that. And we already had that in a couple of other cases, but really this is demonstrating the issue a lot. And the bigger problem more is in this case more to balance U.S. law and European law, because the core problem of the prison case is that under European Union law, you cannot just have mass access by a government. And a European company like Facebook in Ireland cannot just give a foreign government mass access to all their data. However, in the U.S. law, they are obliged to give exactly this mass access. And this is something that's really seriously troublesome for multinationals, because they're kind of in between these two legal systems. And right now, it's kind of the question of which legal system is hurting me more if I don't stick to it. And very likely, it's the American system that is going to hurt you more. So you have this thing. So the big problem here is more to have a diplomatic solution to it in the end. We can only bring up the problem in the end. And the underlying issue is really to have have these two jurisdictions that companies are sticking to or have to stick to. The other thing is that also the Fourth Amendment is much more limited than our protection of privacy. So there was only certain infringements of what we call privacy that are protected under it. So the scope is smaller from what issues it kind of protects. Plus, it doesn't protect any foreigners, and that is something that is really increasingly troublesome. If you think that all these international companies are U.S. based, or at least somehow in the U.S., and U.S. laws are just fully applied to foreigners, theoretically, the U.S. could change their laws, like their normal laws, to also respect the privacy of other people. The problem is that under constitutional law, you can sue them to do that. It's more of a political thing. And in the U.S., they're right now not willing to give any European any rights. That is really something where you could possibly go through these cases and say, for American companies, this is a serious harm. You lose money in Europe if you're not giving these rights. And I could see that then there would be a lot of lobbying in Washington to protect Europeans too, to be able to have all the cloud services and stuff. That would be kind of the next step down the road, and that would be kind of interesting. And that's partly why we're looking into the safe harbor thing as well, and the whole prison complaint, to say, okay, there is a problem, and if we can fuck companies in Europe with that, they will fuck then the American government, and then we probably get to a solution. But that is kind of a long chain to go down. But it's at least worth poking around there and seeing what happens.
De rettigheder, vi europæere har, er universelle, og de gælder også for alle andre, der opholder sig her hos os. Men sådan er det ikke med Amerika. Den amerikanske regering kan kræve alle oplysninger om alle andre end amerikanere. Vi har ingen rettigheder i forhold til dem, og det giver Europa massive problemer i forhold til datasikkerhed, når vi benytter os af amerikanske firmaer her i Europa, og det er det, Max Schrems i al hurtigt snakkende beskedenhed er i gang med at prøve at lave om på, sammen med sine 25.000 støtter. Men har Europa egentlig reageret ordentligt på Snowdens afsløringer? Hvorfor gør vi ikke noget, spørger jeg ham.
Do you think people really understand what this means?
No, and I think it's held back to... I mean, first of all, it's very hard to understand for people how this actually works. That is the reason why they always focus on people and not the subject matter, because it's also complicated how this is done. However, what Snowden helped is that people had a general feeling that this is strange and that they should do something about it. I call it like the Chernobyl of data protection. It's like the point where everyone understood that something is wrong here. You might not understand how a atomic power plant works, but you might feel that this is a little strange, like having it right in your front yard.
And it's getting hot in here.
Yeah, and this is kind of what happened in the Snowden case. I think that people understood that there's just a crazy amount of spying that even I, being more of a privacy person, would have said is insane and a conspiracy theory or something like that before. And that was kind of the big deal. And these battles are in the intellectual level is on arguments, on facts, but in the broader audience it's more of a feeling of it feels strange that an app on your phone is suddenly asking you all these permissions. It feels strange that suddenly you get kind of a personal, you buy shoes and 3 days later shoes are following you all over the internet. That's things that people may not understand technically, but they feel that something is going the wrong way. And I think Snowden was big on that feeling side for a lot of people in a way. However, in Europe, we generally have the issue that we're still so shy to stand up to the U.S. We're still not realizing that we're the bigger market, that these companies have to be here, that we can enforce the laws if we want to. And there's still this kind of general tendency of having the feeling that we're kind of the small brother of the U.S. that has to stick by the rules of whatever the bigger brother is telling us. And that's something that's seriously upsetting to me. I think partly that's bigger in Austria also because we've always been kind of neutral and that was a big issue there. But this kind of general feeling that you could not criticize the U.S., especially in like the higher political ranking spheres, is something that is kind of very strange. And it's not about kind of being generally anti-US because a lot of the things make sense, but you have at least a debate that is kind of balanced and that also says that certain things are wrong and not working. And that's something I'm missing a lot in politics, that we're kind of, whenever it comes to problems of the US and, I don't know, Guantanamo and stuff like that, and like serious human rights violations, suddenly we're not as active as another country. And that is really something that's kind of strange if you look at it from like a neutral perspective in a way.
Og det var altså Max Schrems, jurastuderende fra Østrig, og i gang med at slås mod Facebook. Hvis du vil være med, så kan du skrive dig op i køen som medsagsøger på adressen Europe vs. Facebook. Vi skal nok lægge et link op på vores hjemmeside på aflytte.dk og på vores egen Facebook-side. I sidste uge, der kunne Aflytte fortælle om den danske app, der hedder Denkrypt. Den gør din telefon sikker mod aflytning, men den er kun til store firmaer og til regeringsinstitutioner, og blandt andet har Forsvarsministeriet lige købt en ordentlig bunke af den. Men hvis du nu som ganske almindelig lille privatperson er blevet rigtig træt af, at nogen som helst kan lytte med på, hvad der foregår på din telefon, så kan du for godt $700 købe dig en helt aflytningssikker telefon. Det hæver det i hvert fald de mennesker, der har lavet den. Den hedder Blackphone. Direktøren for Blackphone, han hedder Toby Weir Jones, han er amerikaner. Produktet er udviklet af amerikaner, men selve firmaet, det ligger i Schweiz, og det er der en række ret gode grunde til. Mød ham og Blackphone her.
Have you got one with you?
I do.
Yeah. Could I get you to kind of describe what does it look like?
So by design, it looks like many mobile phones that you've used before.
How many megapixels is the camera? How long is it running on battery and stuff like that? That's what people ask.
Sure. Well, I can give you a data sheet if you want. The main camera is 8 megapixel. So it's fine. It's not, again, a 20 megapixel monster. Battery life is good for at least a day and potentially 2 or 3 days depending on your usage. So again, it's pretty good. The device it performs well. It's clearly it's not meant to be the latest and greatest, comparable to, you know, curved glass, whatever magic that we see in Las Vegas every year. But you know, for an enterprise user that's focused on essentially doing your work or going about your communications safely, the CPU performance is good, the battery performance is good, the storage is good, the camera is good. The network performance is actually very good. It runs a modified version of Android KitKat, which we call Private OS. The key differentiation is that we supply a series of privacy-minded tools for encrypted communications. So you can have encrypted voice phone calls, video chats. You can send and receive encrypted text messages. You can use file transfer. You can browse the web anonymously. You can perform anonymous search. And then you can store files in an encrypted cloud, again, so that you can access them from other mobiles or from your desktop computers.
So you're actually providing for people who are not that tech savvy, you're actually providing them the possibility to kind of go total black hat on the world.
That's right. The tools all come preloaded on the phone. The subscriptions are prepaid. Everything is ready to go when you take it out of the box. You can configure it to work with your enterprise environment, so it'll respond to policy instructions if you want to put a device management policy on it or whatever else your company may want to do. But as a private citizen, essentially what you have is none of the leaky behaviors of your standard, let's say, mainstream mobile phones. So, for example, there's no harvesting of your personal contacts. There's no reporting of your search history or the contents of your email. And that allows you to make the choice about where your personal information goes and who can see it.
Blackphone ligner det, den hedder. En helt sort klods uden ret meget pynt. Den er lidt større end en iPhone 4, og hvis man kan sige, at en telefon har en udstråling, så udstråler den her telefon en følelse af værktøj og soliditet.
Men det med at udstråle noget som helst i praksis, det er lige præcis det, den ikke gør. Den lægger ikke data til nogen som helst, og så har den en helt særlig ekstra feature. Den holder øje med, om nogen prøver på at logge den på et ukendt netværk via Wi-Fi-forbindelsen. Sådan et ukendt netværk, det kan nemlig være en aflytningsstation, eller det kan være et kommercielt firma, dit lokale supermarked, eller lufthavnen, der prøver at aflure dig dine indkøbsmønstre eller lave big data af dine bevægelser. Og det finder en Blackphone så ikke i.
So it will turn the Wi-Fi radio off altogether, unless you specifically tell it to connect to a network which you indicate is trusted. And the beauty there is that as you walk down the street, the main street, or you walk through an airport or anything else, all of the Wi-Fi beacon technology cannot detect your phone, so you can't be tracked and then associated with any purchases you make or any movements, because none of that location information or purchasing behavior is measurable.
How often is that necessary?
I'm sorry, how often?
How often is that? Is this something you run into often? You must be able
it
to
is.
See a lot.
The proliferation of Wi-Fi beacons has been huge into especially large retailers, coffee shops, stores, clothing stores, bookstores even. And it is a recurring problem because people, it's passive. There's no way for you to know that your device has been observed and tracked. So what we do is we simply turn it off so that it can't be tracked in the first place. And then, you know, the problem shifts and you don't need to worry about where your data might have ended up.
One of the main questions you have to ask yourself here in Europe is, how can we trust you? You are from the United States. How can we trust Blackphone?
We are actually not a U.S. company. We are a Swiss corporation. We do have offices in a number of countries, including the U.S., but all of our data centers, all of our corporate legal presence is Swiss and therefore protected by Swiss law. The key advantage there is ultimately that if there is an attempt to request information, under Swiss law, the individual or the entity is protected by a right of disclosure. So if someone came asking questions about one of our customers and went through the Swiss courts to do it, we would be able to tell the customer that request had been made. But the other more important point is that by design, the way the phone works, we don't have any collectible information about what phone calls you make or what text messages or who you communicate with. None of those records exist. So there's nothing for me to hand over, even if a court order is presented.
One of the classic things to judge a piece of software is whether it's open source, and I can actually look it through. Is all your software open source?
Everything that we can release is slated for open source release. We do use some third-party commercial tools on the phone from, for example, our CPU partner, NVIDIA. We can't release those under open source because it's not our code. But we've already started to release. We've released the source for our kernel mods, and there will be more coming throughout the course of this year and beyond. Not only raw source, but also annotations. We've already done a bug bounty program where people can be rewarded for finding bugs and vulnerabilities in our code or our websites. That's also been very successful in terms of, I think, improving transparency about how we work. And we're committed to that. We believe it's possible to make a business that thrives as a result of this kind of community participation in the security space.
There's one more question. How is business going? Is it a big seller?
Business is very good. We consistently sell out of our mass production runs, and we consistently have to increase the size of those runs for subsequent orders. I'm expecting that by the end of next year, we're probably on track to sell between 10 and 20 million devices.
Selvom Toby Weir Jones er amerikaner, så er firmaet bag fra Schweiz. Blackphone produceres af Silent Circle, der blandt andet har den verdensberømte kryptograf Phil Zimmermann som medstifter, og alle deres server, de står i Europa, så NSA ikke kan få adgang til dem. Men når man laver et så skudsikkert produkt som Blackphone, hvad så med terrorister og kriminelle? De kan jo også bruge det.
So if you make a device like this, which is totally secure and you can't see what's going on inside, that must attract some attention from, let's say, more darker sides of the telecommunication business.
It certainly attracts attention. And one of the reasons we don't use, for example, proprietary hardware is to keep the cost down, and because we do most of our work in software. And by making the software open source, the incentive to try and see under the covers is reduced because everybody can see already. You know, the value is not in secrets about how the phone works. The value is in what the phone enables for the user. And our prerogative is that these sorts of technologies, whether it's encryption or anonymity or whatever it might be, these are mainstream technologies, and what we're trying to do is make them accessible and usable, including disclosure on how they work. And that allows the user to feel certainly a measure of comfort and a measure of knowledge that they can choose why they trust us, not just if they trust us. And ultimately, that's a critical part of the relationship. We are a company rather than a science project. So again, we have resources for customer support, for R&D, for sales training, all these other sorts of things that a typical enterprise buyer is going to need. But at the same time, we're very visible and active in the security research community. We make sure that we have a presence and people have a way to reach us with the more sophisticated questions, the more complex inquiries about how we work.
If I was this might be a stupid question, but it actually concerns, there's a Danish company who's actually just released an algorithm and a small app you can put into the phone. But they're saying they don't want to sell that to private people because it might be used by criminals. But
there's always going to be a very small segment of the market that is essentially going to use any tool for illicit purposes, whether it's a ladder or a car or a phone. I can't prevent that. It doesn't matter what kind of tool I make, and I don't believe that we create the intent to cause harm or be malicious simply by making the tool available. That predisposition already exists among the criminal element. Ultimately, we believe it's more important to democratize these technologies and make them available for legitimate use, law-abiding use, because the right to privacy is fundamental. It's about the right to assembly. It's about the right to discourse, questioning your government, having an ability to pursue legitimate questions, not just illicit activity. But if you lose that right to privacy, your ability to organize, your ability to communicate amongst like-minded thinkers is compromised. And we believe that that's ultimately a far more important goal.
One of the consequences of you making this phone is you're actually putting, you're mainly putting intelligence services out of business. They can't snoop on anything. If anyone, if everybody gets a phone like this, they can't snoop on people. Aren't they a bit worried about you?
There are certainly elements of that. It's a cat and mouse game, right? And the problem we have with all of these state actors and the sort of sophisticated surveillance apparatus is we know a bit about their capabilities, but we don't really know everything. And we probably never will. So all we can do is ensure that the tools are high quality and that they've undergone peer review. The benefits of open source. And then ensure that people know how to use them correctly. That's ultimately one of the easiest ways to compromise something is by finding a user that is, perhaps not as well informed as they should be about how the tools can work. Even though we provide encrypted voice communications, it's still a GSM phone. And if you place a regular GSM phone call on it, that phone call can, of course, be intercepted by the carrier or the operator whose network you're traversing. If somebody doesn't understand that difference, then they expose themselves to that kind of capture. Maybe it doesn't matter if you're placing a call to grandmother on Sunday afternoon. But if you're talking about sensitive business dealings or travel plans with your family or whatever it might be, you should have the right to assert that choice. And, if that makes the world a little more difficult, the cost of detection for a surveillance apparatus a little higher, I'm okay with that.
Aflyttet er forbi for i dag. Jeg hedder Anders Kjærulf, og programmet er optaget på CPDP-konferencen i Bruxelles. Det her CPDP, det står for Computers Privacy and Data Protection, og det er altså en konference i Bruxelles. Jeg kan allerede nu love, at der kommer meget mere hernede fra, for jeg har optaget en frygtelig masse andet, og vi vender naturligvis tilbage i næste uge med mere nyt fra det her matsorte overvågningssamfund, vi alle sammen bor i. Her, hvor ordene står i kø og gerne vil ud, gerne vil fremad, hen over bakken om på den anden side og hen til krukken med guld for enden af regnbuen, men den flytter sig jo som bekendt hele tiden, så vi er nødt til at stå stille og drømme om sandheden i en sjæl og et legeme. Det bliver ikke lige nu, men måske om lidt. Call connected to the NSA. Complete transmission to the NSA. Suspending your rights for the duration of the permanent